This is an ABC podcast. This is the WA Country Hour with Belinda Varischetti on ABC Radio WA.
Well, hello there. Great to have you along on this Friday afternoon. This hour, a southwest seed potato grower is concerned about the spread of a virus through potato crops in Tasmania, saying it could affect international exports. And being a Friday, we will be checking in on what's happened on the wool market this week here in the west and also at sales in the eastern states. And following record lamb and sheep prices at the sale yards, it sounds like there was a fair bit of optimism among sheep breeders at the Darren Field Days this week.
People are optimistic. A lot of the merino guys are seeing the shortfall of the wool supply that's going to come up as potentially adding another arrow in the quiver, and that really the industry could be looking at golden times ahead.
We'll look into that in some more detail a little later this hour after the news headlines at 12:30. 12:06 here on the Country Hour. Well, WA sheep producers have shown very little interest in the V&V Walsh forward contracts on offer since the start of the month. The meat processor and exporter based at Bunbury is offering producers forward contracts for premium heavy lambs over August and September at $10.20 per kilogram. A forward contract at that price, over $10 a kilo, at this time of year is unheard of and a sign really of just how difficult it is for the processors to source lambs and meet market commitments. Brent Dancer is the General Manager of V&V Walsh. Brent, what response has there been to these forward contracts?
Look, positivity in terms of the rhetoric and the conversation on the fact that we're out there and giving those indications to the market. Unfortunately, to be honest, there's been little take-up so far, and so that's something we're still hoping to see a little bit more take up in the coming weeks before the supply comes on. But you know, again, positivity that we're out there giving indications, just not a lot of take up from agents and producers just yet.
And when you say not a lot of take up, can you put a number on that?
I could probably count them on my two hands. So yeah, very little.
Okay,
to be honest, the volume that we're looking for.
So why such a poor take up?
Look, I don't know, to be brutally honest. I think there's a little bit of people thinking that there might be more positivity out in the market and therefore don't want to sign up to it yet, hoping that there might be more money in it. Whether there's people, you know, using that to have other conversations, there's a lot of good positive news out there around the price for sheep at the moment for producers, which is fantastic. And so is it that, you know, people are hoping that there might be a little bit more in it and therefore not aligning to it? That's all I can probably put my finger on at the moment, because we're seeing supply starting to come, and so when that supply does start to come, you know, we're still seeing that there might be that usual spring pinch that might come on.
Well, it is understandable, I guess, in a rising market that producers are sort of shopping around and maybe even trying their luck in the sale yard, especially when, you know, we've got good pens of lambs that can get the $400 per head record price that was set at Mushay last week.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And the price at the sale yard is strong at the moment, which is great to see for the producers. And so, look, absolutely, people are trying to make sure that they can get the most for their lambs when they're ready to turn them off. Again, I think it's one of those ones where with some of these forward contracts, that the purpose of them is to really get that longer-term view to things. And so, you know, we actually think our current forward contract that's in the market is probably right on the money, given where supply is starting to come on. It's probably still a couple of weeks away for spring lamb. We're seeing a few start to trickle through the facility now, which is fantastic. But our bookings are getting pretty well close to full without some of those forward contracts even being triggered yet. So space is going to start to get tight through those typical spring flush periods.
Would you look at upping that price? The current contract is at $10.20 per kilogram, or you think that's on the money?
No, look, we think that's on the money. I mean, the East Coast came off almost a dollar or over a dollar last week. The gap between us and the East is getting pretty comparable, and the markets from a customer point of view just aren't willing to pay the price. So at the moment, from a processor point of view, especially the East Coast, there's a lot of processors in a bit of strife and struggling to make ends meet. A lot of them are back to 3 and 4 day production because they just can't actually make it work at these prices. And so we think where we sit at the moment is a very strong price that is a good starting position for spring lamb. And we'll see how the market and the supply moves once they start to come on in good numbers.
What are the consequences of not fulfilling the contract?
At this stage, that's some of the challenges, that there isn't a great deal. So that once we sign up, we sort of start to take forward positions in markets with our customers on the basis that those lambs are coming. At this stage, there's unfortunately not a lot of recourse back to those that have signed up if they don't supply those lambs. And something that we're really starting to try and work through with the agent networks to say that if we're going to commit to some of these longer term contracts and go into market, export markets with some longer positions, with the surety that supply is coming, we need to see them honoured all the way through as well.
And what could be some of those consequences then? What's on the table for consideration?
Look, we haven't sort of got to that point at the moment. We're hoping we can actually just build the trust with the agents' networks that those will be honoured. Ultimately, that's, you know, the name of the game is for us all to work together to make sure that we get that consistency in market and get the right price for everyone to make everything work. So we want to stay away from the negativity piece if we can just work together on getting good outcomes for everyone.
So what about longer-term contracts? That's quite appealing to a lot of producers, and I guess for a lot of them it puts that confidence in the industry, to stay in the industry. Is that something that you think is going to be part of this industry longer-term?
Look, I really don't think it's going to be possible for the 12-month sort of contracts. Ultimately, somebody has to wear risk and share risk. And in export markets, customers generally aren't willing to look at more than 3 months. And so when you're talking about a 12-month contract, there's going to be risk borne by somebody. And we think that a 12-month forward contract or longer-term forward contract really starts to make some challenge on those positions. We do see on the beef side, though, that you can get some programs like your 150-day, 200-day grain-fed programs that can sort of get that assurity through. And we are finding customers in various markets that are willing to back in the log onto the feedlots through those programs. But it is obviously, it comes with a heightened level of risk if prices are to move in those markets quickly.
What about the product that you process that goes into the supermarkets, though, the local WA supermarkets? Isn't it possible to negotiate a deal there with the supermarkets that you can then pass on in a forward contract form to producers in a longer format, say a 12-month format?
With the supermarkets, generally we're just a service provider, so we're not actually putting our own product in. We're a service provider to the supermarkets in terms of procurement and processing. So it's not actually our product. Again, with those ones, it's moving with the market. So supply, demand, the pricing of which the supermarkets are willing to put on the price on the shelves. And it has to be across the whole domestic supply chain, not just the supermarkets, but then the independents, the butcher shops. Because what we do find the challenge, and for our local butchers and independents that do a fantastic job here in WA, if the price comparison between the supermarkets and what they need to get out from their side isn't comparable, it makes it really difficult for those butchers and independents in the local market.
So just to wrap up, Brent, what sort of situation or challenge does it present for the company trying to keep commitments to your markets when not many people have signed up, as you said earlier, for the forward contracts, in terms of getting your hands on the supply that you need to fulfil those commitments?
Look, we're still confident about the position that we've got. We've got some fantastic producers that we do have long-term relationships with, and we'll continue to develop those close relationships with those good farmers that we have had long-term relationships with and trusted partnerships with. It does make it a little bit tricky with some of the longer-term programs in the export markets, and so we have to be a little bit more spot rather than the longer positions. And so that's just something that we'll continue to navigate, depending on supply and how the prices sort of play out over the grids and in the sale yards.
Brent, great to talk to you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Brent Dancer, who's the General Manager of V&V Walsh. 14 past 12.
The Country Hour, celebrating 80 years.
Dun, dun, dun. That's right,
we're 3 hours from Catherine, doing School of the Air.
Celebrating 80 years of telling rural stories
on ABC Radio.
A $350 million upgrade of the port at Geraldton is going to focus on reducing lengthy delays to ship loading, which is currently being experienced due to surge. On average, the port loses 32 days of ship loading each year because of poor weather. But the Port Authority is hoping to more than halve that figure through construction of a 400-metre breakwater. CEO of Midwest Ports, Damien Tully, says the project is due to start construction next year, and considering the surge problems this year, it really can't come soon enough.
Surge has had a massive impact on port operations, not just for CBH, but for all our customers across the port this year. And this has been one of the worst years that we've had. And I suppose what I'd say is that surge is an impact of swell. It comes from weather events. And I think everyone can realise at the moment that we're seeing an unprecedented number of weather events affecting us over the winter this year.
And has that been the worst period, winter?
Yeah, so traditionally we do see surge impacts increasing and also the swell impacts from those winter storms coming up from the southwest.
When I think about last year in comparison to this year, we enjoyed quite a lot of rain last winter and we have done again this winter. Has there been something different or something particular about the systems that have been coming through to cause this much of an impact?
I think from my point of view, I've seen there's been larger storms coming through and we've had successive fronts coming through as well. So what that's meant is we've had to evacuate the harbour probably more often, whereas the smaller weather events that have come through, we've been able to ride them out through mitigating circumstances. But this year it's just been a number of really large events coming through one after the other.
And that then, I suppose, causes further delays when you evacuate the harbour, when you get all those ships out.
Yeah, so we have to evacuate the harbour beforehand, but we also need to take into account, especially for, say, grain, whether there's actually going to be any rain beforehand. So if there's going to be rain before a weather event, well, then we'll end up evacuating the ships a little bit earlier because we know that we're not going to be able to make the thresholds required to keep the ships stable out in the channel. We're certainly aware of the concerns of our customers and the flow and that effect that it has had to the farmers and to the region overall. And that's the reason why we are working so closely with our customers to make sure that we can get as much tonnage out of the port as we can at the moment, with a longer-term view to improving efficiency with the installation of a new surge protection breakwater.
CBH say they've lost about 900 hours of loading since October last year through to now, which doubles the previous record. And a miner that I've spoken to says they've lost 250 hours in July alone. It's a lot when you add all that up. Does that problem that there seems to be make Geraldton unattractive for exporters if they have a choice of where to go to load?
So I would say that this is an exceptional year in terms of the impact. And when we look at previous years, we have actually enjoyed some very good years where we've had less impact. So I think it is a bit of an anomaly. But I suppose the thing I'd really like to highlight is that we are looking at a longer-term solution, and it's fantastic to see the state government investing in port infrastructure so that we can mitigate some of these impact of surge into the future and actually enjoy better efficiency across the port.
And that is the port maximisation project that you're referring to. When you were making the case for that, was there economic modelling done of the economic cost of surge? Because when you look at those hours and the delays around them just this year alone, it's a lot. But is there a bigger figure that you look at?
So when we first put the port maximisation project together, we're actually really looking at future growth and looking at expanding the capacity of the port. But at the same time, we were doing a study on surge and how to prevent surge. Mm. And the government rightly made a fantastic decision to say, let's put that into the port maximisation project. And that's actually become the number one priority of the actual project, to install this new breakwater, which will actually reduce the impact of surge. We're hoping by around 60 to 80% reduction in the number of port closure days we have each year.
So how will that work? What's that going to look like?
Essentially, because we have the weather wrapping around the Geraldton Peninsula, we actually see that surge, which is a function of the swell, come over the reef and come into the port, and it sort of reverberates around the port, making conditions unsafe. once it's over a certain level. What this breakwater will allow us to do is create a bit of a shadow over the port and also parts of Champion Bay, so the town beaches, which will mean that a lot of that weather won't come into the port and we'll actually be able to load for a lot longer than we currently do. So on average, we lose around about 32 days of port closures per year. We're hoping to see a significant reduction in that with the installation of the breakwater.
And quite a significant breakwater too, by the sound of it.
Yeah, so we'll stretch some 400 metres out into Champion Bay. So where we actually have some of our port infrastructure at the moment, it will essentially move a little bit further out. But that's what that's required in order to create that shadow. So we actually do see that reduction within the harbour.
And you were saying mitigating the impact of surge, that's become the number one priority for the port maximisation project. What's the timeframe around that?
Yeah, so it is the number one priority because it will actually be the greatest delivery of efficiencies for the port to make it more efficient than it is today. So we've got our environmental approvals in at the moment under review. So we've been spending some time doing our design over the last year and a half. So the environmental approvals, we're expecting approval towards the end of this calendar year, and we look to commence construction next year. So what that will mean is that over the next 2 years or the year and a half as it's constructed, we'll start to enjoy a reduction in surge, and ultimately in 2 years' time, we'll see the complete effect. We also currently have a truck unloader for our mineral sands products under construction down at the port at the moment, and also a number of other things like changing our road network so that we're able to take larger wind turbine blades into the future. So it is a multifaceted project that's making quite a lot of improvements down at the port.
CEO of Midwest Ports, Damien Tully, speaking to Joe Prendergast. 21 past 12. Midwest iron ore miner and exporter Fenix Resources says delays in shipping due to surge events at the Geraldton port create a significant ongoing challenge for the business. Fenix say in July the Geraldton port was closed for 250 hours due to surge and delayed loading of two ships. Fenix Executive Chair John Wellborn says the planned $350 million port upgrade to reduce surge events is most welcome.
Surge events are certainly affecting the efficiency of vessel transport. We work very closely with the Midwest Port Authority, attempting to make sure that we can manage our vessel movements around the somewhat random impact of surge-related, safety-related closures of the port. But obviously, in months like we've seen in July, where there was more than 10 days of surge event closures, it becomes really difficult.
Grain ships are here for extended periods, some for up to more than 30 days, 44 days is the maximum that I've heard, trying to load. What's the usual turnaround time when it comes to an iron ore vessel? Are you experiencing that much of a bank up?
Fortunately, no, and that does seem like a long time, Joe. We try and get our boats in and out in 24 hours. So we are loading around about 60,000 tonnes of iron ore on Berth 5 in Geraldton, where we have on-wharf storage facilities that we own and control, and so we store iron ore, and then we load, the Midwest Port Authority can load that material from our storage facilities at about 3,000 tonnes an hour. Okay. So roughly 20 hours, and then you add the time of getting the boat on and off the wharf. So, no, we try and get our boats in and out and away from Geraldton as quickly as possible, because obviously it's a big cost to us if there's demurrage, if there is delays and the ship is required to stay at anchor. That's inefficient.
When you look at your business structure, you're mining the product, you're hauling it to port, and then you're exporting it. When you have a month like July, and you were saying there was 250 hours of loading lost in July alone, what effect does that have on your business, John?
It's a big effect. We published our annual financial results yesterday, and it was a record year for Fenix. We shipped and sold 2.4 million tonnes per annum, and that's up around a million tonnes from the prior year. What we didn't say in that report is that there were two ships that were delayed. We were hoping to get those ships in June, and they were pushed out into July, not entirely due to surge events, but certainly that would have been one factor. And so then we had two ships in early July, and then we obviously had a lot of surge delays. So fortunately, we adjust our shipping, and we obviously have an integrated supply line right from our mine, which is out near Kew and Meekatharra in the World Range. Then we own and operate the Newhaul Road Logistics business, and we have the Newhaul Port Services business that, that then stores and loads our iron ore. And so because we control all elements of that, we can adjust. But the most important thing is to be efficient with our ship movements. So the impact on surge events effectively slows down our ability to ship and therefore delays the receipt of revenue. So, but obviously also we're very ambitious. We think we can continue. We, you know, we've created 300 jobs in the Midwest through the construction and expansion of our mining activities. We think there's further scope for that. But the, you know, when we think the our facilities at Geraldton Port could actually have a capacity of up to 10 million tonnes of export, and that would be a huge boost for us and for the region. But it does, we're looking at a whole series of opportunities as to how we could make our port export volumes more efficient. And one of those is obviously limiting surge event, which is great that the state government and the Midwest Port Authority have a plan around PMAX and the construction of a breakwater. And the other one is what we can invest in to make loading and storage not only more efficient, but also more environmentally effective. So we do a lot of work to control dust and to make sure that the product isn't being degraded. So that's both an environmental impact as well as a product quality advantage.
The PMAX plan is to build a 400-metre breakwater at the port, basically creating a shadow, which the port is hoping will reduce the delays from surge by 60 to 80%, so fairly ambitious. Does that project, that getting off the ground and being built, does that determine how successful and how much volume you will be able to get out? Ultimately, is it hinged on that breakwater?
It's certainly a big factor. If we had months like July of this year repeated, then that would limit the numbers that I've referred to that PMAX is targeting as the available export capacity of Geraldton Port. We wouldn't be able to achieve those tons. So yes, I think the efficiency of Geraldton Port, and we're just one small part of that, we're one customer of the port, are directly tied to the development of the breakwater and the other efficiencies that PMAX delivers. So the state government and the Midwest Port Authority are on the right track with that investment, and the sooner it gets developed and implemented, the better. I think there's some other advantages for Geraldton as well, as I understand it, in terms of creating more capacity in the port generally. But from a bulk commodity exporter, I'm completely aligned with CBH and their recognition that this is a really important productivity opportunity for the Midwest.
Fenix Executive Chair John Wellborn speaking to Joe Prendergast. 28 past 12 here on the Country Hour. Earlier in the hour, we were talking about how WA producers have shown very little interest in the V&V Walsh forward contracts on offer since the start of the month. And the contracts were for $10.20 a kilogram for premium heavy lambs over August and September. And Brent Dancer, the general manager at V&V Walsh, was saying he could sort of count the producers who've signed on the dotted line on both of his hands. So not really keen at all. Kelvin from Narrambeen has texted through. Hello, Kelvin. He says, great questions to Walsh's. The Walsh contract is very good. We need long-term contracts to ensure security. The sheep industry is so far behind the grain industry, which allows farmers to take out year-round contracts and store, which is why people in medium rainfall zones are leaving the sheep industry after 2 years of heavy losses. Sheep used to be a risk management option, but with modern grain growing and grain marketing, sheep are now the risk. No amount of money will make those exiting or cutting numbers change their mind. The sheep and wool industry are fast becoming cottage industries and only suitable for high rainfall zones. Thanks, Kelvin. The text is 0448 922 604. 29 past 12, Jonathan Beale is here with the news headlines.
Thanks, Belinda. A firearms enthusiast with access to high-powered weapons has been found guilty of threatening a senior WA police officer. Army reservist Mitchell John Hogan called Acting Inspector Ken Walker's mobile in September last year and repeated the phrase, "We're coming for you, Ken." Inspector Walker had been advising the WA government on gun law reform. The matter is due back in court in October. Northern detectives are investigating reports a man may have threatened a forestry worker with a firearm in the central wheat belt. Police say they removed a report, rather they received a report about 4 o'clock on Wednesday afternoon that a man confronted the worker near a makeshift hut in bushland near Watershed Road, about 60 kilometres west of Beverley. Police say no injuries were reported, but there were unconfirmed reports that the suspect had a firearm. And severe weather and blizzards in Victoria's Alpine area are hampering efforts to locate a man accused of shooting and killing two police officers. The area around Porepunkah is expected to be hit by blizzard conditions and plummeting temperatures. 56-year-old Desi Freeman is wanted over the fatal shooting at his property on Tuesday. Last night, police arrested Mr. Freeman's 42-year-old wife and a 15-year-old boy. They were later released from custody pending further inquiries. More news, Belinda, at 1 o'clock.
Thank you so much, Jonathan. 29 to 1.
The farmers innovating and adapting to cope with drought.
What do? Do I feed the sheep? I can't afford to feed them. I can't afford not to feed them.
That's Landline, Sunday 12:30 on ABC TV and iView.
And some Western Australian scientists will feature on this Sunday's Landline episode 2, and they're talking about sheep as well. They're trying to find the best sort of shelter for sheep, plants that offer shelter and food. You'll hear more about that shortly. And of course, being a Friday, we will take a look at this week's wool market results. And some seed potato growers here in WA concerned about the spread of a virus through potato crops in Tasmania could affect international exports. We'll get to that shortly. First, making our way to the Bureau of Meteorology, Catherine Shelfout with you today. Clear skies across most of the Southwest Land Division this afternoon by the looks of things, Catherine. Is that right?
There is. I have to say I'm enjoying the pleasant sunshine after, well, we've had really wet conditions near the west coast. I know that doesn't apply to everyone, but it's nice to see a little bit of sun for a while. So there is a fair bit of cloud near the south coast, and it has been quite cloudy over the southern goldfields and the Southwest Land Division, but that is clearing as the temperature warms up a bit. So what's driving this is quite a strong ridge moving in. So the centre of the high associated with the ridge is 1,037 hectopascals, which is more like what we see in summer. So pretty strong ridge, but definitely sitting in the kind of position we usually see in springtime. So just along the south coast, and in doing that, it kind of blocks any cold fronts coming up. And we do get those clear skies and light winds under the ridge. So it's a bit of a frost risk. But basically, the story for the next 4 days will be warming daytime temperatures and cold nights. So just quickly going through those 4 days. On Saturday, we will see that high moving over the southern goldfields and the Great Southern. So temperatures dropping below 3 degrees for much of the wheat belt and Great Southern. So coldest looks like it'll be around that Lake Grace wandering sort of latitude. Pretty light winds across the Southwest Land Division throughout the day, but northern parts of the central west around Mullewa can expect a little bit stronger easterly winds in the morning. Northerly through most of the rest of the Southwest Land Division, but as I mentioned, quite light. So frost a definite overnight risk there tonight into tomorrow morning, and also some fog possible through southern parts. Daytime temps, we're looking at about 16 for Katanning and Mount Barker, reaching up to around 23 at Kalbarri. And the only chance of showers is really that far southwest corner between Busselton and Walpole, and not expecting very much at all. On Sunday, that high does move a little further east to around about Eucla. but there's still quite a strong ridge pushing back over the southwest land division. So another cold morning with a broad area of frost risk across inland parts. So the coldest for Sunday morning, that area around Corrigan, sitting around 0 degrees, and still wandering in Lake Grace, that region as well. We will see max temps about a degree warmer, so going for 19 at Meriden on Sunday and 20 for Mora. And wind still pretty light, mostly northerly in the morning, and east-northeasterly through northern parts of the central west. Again, just light showers southwest of about Busselton to Albany, but dry elsewhere. And then Monday and Tuesday, we'll see that ridge persisting, but we do start to see a little trough forming along the Pilbara coast Sunday afternoon and then extending down the west coast Monday and Tuesday. So that's definitely a spring pattern. Very weak front will cross the southwest corner Monday afternoon, so there'll be a bit of cloud around southwestern parts and just a chance of a millimetre or two between Bunbury and Albany. Still another cold morning, with widespread frost risk again, Corrigan, Narrogin sort of sitting below 2 degrees again. Maybe a little bit more fog around through southern parts with just that added moisture. And we do start to see northwesterly winds strengthening over southern parts as that front moves through, so along the south coast and just inland. And then by Tuesday, back to pretty light northerly winds with that ridge dominating again. Slightly warmer overnight temperatures Tuesday morning, so sort of in that 2 to 4 degree range through inland parts. And quite cloudy near the south coast with just some light showers between Busselton and Bremer Bay. So a smaller frost risk area on Tuesday morning. And, yeah, Tuesday will be the warmest day near the west coast. So going for 29 at Kalbarri, 24 at Gingin with that sort of northerly flow. And we'll see most of that warmth moving east on Wednesday with an approaching cold front. So I just heard the Newdigat field days are coming up mid-next week. We do have another cold front coming through Wednesday. We're pretty uncertain about the timing and strength of it at the moment, but it looks like something is there. Also the chance of maybe some mid-level sort of rainfall coming down, not too convincing at this stage, but maybe seeing some patchy stuff over eastern parts of the southwest land division. So winter's not over yet, the Wednesday system, and then it definitely looks like something coming through later in the week as well.
And what about conditions across northern and eastern parts, Catherine?
So it's been really windy over the north and over the Eucla and eastern parts of the state as well, and it will continue to be dry and warm over northern WA for the next few days. So that's also driven by this ridge over southern WA. So tomorrow winds in the Eucla will ease because that comes under the influence of the ridge, but the strong and gusty southeasterlies will persist over northern WA, not the far north Kimberley, but certainly the Pilbara, the interior, northern Gascoyne and southern Kimberley throughout tomorrow and Sunday. We are not expecting any rainfall in the north of the state. We do have a slight chance of fog near the northwest Kimberley coast tomorrow, and we will see that trough, as I mentioned, developing near the Pilbara coast on Sunday. So a little bit of a change to the wind pattern, a little bit of an easing in the north and over the Pilbara. So places like Wyndham at the moment are really hot, sitting around 38 degrees. That will reduce a little bit into early next week. And other places sort of further west in the Pilbara, for example, Panamonica, going for 28 today, but increasing up to 34 on Monday and Tuesday as that the winds tend to turn a bit more northeasterly and drag that warmth down.
Thank you so much, Catherine. 22 to 1. Richard Hudson is here now with the rainfall figures.
Yeah, and this won't take long at all. In the southwest, a few places had between 1 and 2 mils, and the only one above that was Jindong with 9. And then in the southern coastal patch, same sort of thing. A number of places had 1 to 2 mils, and above that, Erinair had 4, Esperance Airport 5 mils, and the Duke, I love the Duke, had 5 mils as well. But that's it.
Thanks, Richard. As I mentioned a moment or two ago, scientists from the CSIRO, Monash University and UWA are trying to find the best sort of shelter for sheep and lamb health in Australia. But this is not about building shelters. It's about experimenting with plants that offer shelter and food for the sheep. Monash University's Serena Hancock is involved in the research.
For ewes and rams, when they're exposed to heat stress, there can be reduced fertility, impaired fetal development, and a lower lamb survival. And likewise, for cold stress, that can actually increase mortality rates in newborn lambs, especially for twins.
They're experimenting with vegetation to provide that shelter.
So we want to be able to provide guidelines to producers to be able to limit these impacts on the animals in times of heat stress and in times of cold stress.
Hayley Norman is a senior principal research scientist at CSIRO. Her role is to manage the shrub and foliage component of the project and integrate that within a farming system.
In WA mixed farming systems, cropping is king, and the equipment we use is getting bigger and bigger. So unfortunately, a lot of the shelter is being removed in order to have those nice big lines that farmers can run with their machinery.
She's been using tough plants that can survive in marginal soil and cropping paddocks as shelter shrubs.
You can put them in without losing a lot of crop yield and grow really well in those areas. So if the ewes choose to use shelter and we provide it, we think we have a solution. What we want is the ewe to have a lamb and stay at that birth site for 24 hours while the lambs gather some strength and have a drink. So by having an edible shelter, we think the ewe will have a reason to stay in that spot.
They're currently testing two closely related shrubs, Anamika, or Old Man's Saltbush, and Arigodia.
The saltbush grows really well on sandy soil. You see it up and down the coast. Easy to sow, so cheaper to establish. 9% sapin and nothing wants to eat it. So,
including us.
Saltbush, if you've ever had a chance to taste it, has quite a strong flavour.
It was.
But attracting the sheep to these edible shelters has other useful impacts.
The carcass weights are heavier because we think they're drinking more water in lairage because they're used to have a high salt diet, so they're not as dehydrated as slaughter. And the vitamin E levels in the meat are higher, so you're getting a longer shelf life.
So there's benefits, but maybe the taste isn't that.
Because if you're a connoisseur of lamb, I think you can taste the difference. But when we've tried it scientifically, it's always really tantalisingly close but never quite significant.
Beyond testing the foliage, the research extends to modelling and mapping the impact of cold on sheep and lambs by using historical climate data from across southern Australia. It could help producers anticipate risk and identify when to intervene to save their sheep.
So we're measuring chill index here. Right. This is the wind direction.
Georgia Welsh is a PhD candidate at Murdoch University. She's looking at how wind direction affects lambs. This will help farmers know where to plant shelter shrubs on their property.
By doing this project, we're looking at things like orientation of shrubs and palatability of shrubs as well. Not really being a lot of information about that in terms of ewe behaviour and the effects on lamb survival. We're actually quantifying it.
The program, backed by Meat and Livestock Australia and New South Wales Department of Primary Industries, is a research priority through the National Livestock Research Council. It's producer-led, with some of the research being done on commercial farms. All this work is to make the shelters attractive and palatable, to encourage sheep to use them. But the question had to be asked: why aren't they naturally drawn to shade as a means of survival?
Could be due to predators, and often a ewe will remove itself from the flock because obviously the smell of blood. We know ewes like privacy and they also will move away from the flock. But we think this sort of shelter allows them to stay close to the flock but still have a bit of privacy.
CSIRO's Dr. Hayley Norman finishing that story by Helena Bachkowski. And you can see the full story on Landline this Sunday, 12:30. On ABC TV, or after that you can watch it on iView. 17 to 1 here on the Country Hour. We'll get to the wool market details just before the news at 1. First though, what a difference a year makes. After all the doom and gloom surrounding the announcement of the phase out of the live sheep trade, prices in recent weeks have risen to record levels. Industry optimism was on full display at this week's Darren Field Days. Brett Jones runs a sheep stud near Darren and hopes that optimism carries through to the upcoming ram selling season.
This time last year, the shed was a very, very flat feel in the shed this year. The vibe is completely different. People are optimistic. A lot of the merino guys are seeing the shortfall of the wool supply that's going to come up as potentially adding another arrow in their quiver, and that really the industry could be looking at golden times ahead. Perhaps the wool supply, that shortfall won't be felt until perhaps November or December, but we're pretty sure that it will be felt because there's nothing in the pipeline.
And you've mentioned the golden times ahead. Can you think back to a time when the market and the industry maybe had a similar feel to it?
Not really, no. When we run out of supply, it's hard to predict, you know. It's not that long ago, is it, that mutton and lamb prices were dreadful, and not many people saw the highs that we're enjoying at the moment coming. So, no, I don't.
You've got a sale coming up in a fortnight's time. How are you feeling for that one?
Well, I'm hoping it'll go reasonably well. It's obviously a ram sale. Rams need ewes to be joined to. That's part of the problem. The negativity that was around last year meant there's a lot of ewes gone out of the system. So really, that's the question mark, is how many ewes there are in the system for the rams to be joined to. So whilst there's positivity abounding, we'll see how it goes. I'm sure that the existing loyal customers that we've got will support us well. It's just how many ewes there are in the system.
So there is a market for studs, is what I'm hearing.
There's a market for quality merino rams. There is, yes.
So you haven't been outside the ram shed, but is there anything you're looking to see while you're here at Darwin?
Oh, there'll be a few things that we're going to have a look at while we're in Darwin. Going to have a look at some sheep handling equipment. We're going to have a look at a couple of wands to use on our... we want a second wand to use for our data collection. And we're also going to have a look at a disc seeder for renovating pastures.
A Janding stud owner, Brett Jones, speaking to Anna Cox at the Darwin Field Days. 14-1. Let's jump across to the other side of the country, where Victoria's largest property is on the market, only 7 years after it was last sold to South Australian wool growers, the McBrides, for $70 million. Talopia Downs, a sprawling 47,000-hectare parcel of land adjoining the South Australian border, is expected to have a price tag of more than $100 million on a walk-in, walk-out basis. CEO of AJ and PA McBride, Nathan Wessling, says the company wants to cash in on the property's capital growth.
Generally, once every decade or so, we sell properties to realise the capital gains that happen in Australian agriculture. And we've just made the decision to sell our Victorian property, Talopia Downs, which is a 47,000-hectare property on the SA-Victoria border.
So capital gains, what sort of capital gain are you expecting after having spent $70 million to buy it 7 years ago?
Well, we'll let the market decide that, Angus. But Australian agriculture is one of the best investments throughout history. It achieves about 7% return per year, dating all the way back to Federation. The last few years have been a lot better than that. So we've seen some really good gains across all of our properties, and we're just now taking the step to realise some of that gain.
Have you got a rough idea? Could we be talking cracking the $100 million mark?
Definitely that, yes.
I know at the time when McBride's bought the property, there was a stated intention to hit 10,000 bales of wool produced a year. How close have you got to that figure with Talopia in the enterprise?
We did produce more than 9,000 bales in 1 year a couple of years ago. We've had a couple of quite ordinary seasons, as you will be aware and your listeners will be aware. So we're still around the 8,000 bale mark at the moment. We have recently acquired another property in South Australia last year. It definitely is our medium to long-term goal to continue as a wool producer, and we've still got those goals in mind.
So we shouldn't read anything into this decision that you might... that the company may have declining faith in the wool industry?
I wouldn't say that, no, because we are confident in the performance of our business, and Talopia Downs has been a really good performer for us. And since we acquired Talopia Downs, We actually built a 12-stand shearing shed there, which will shear above 80,000 sheep this year on that property. So we're gearing up for our next wave, and the sale of Tilopia Downs gives us a war chest to look for new properties, help with our succession plans to the next generation of our company as well.
You mentioned what a shocker run in terms of seasonal conditions it's been in South Australia and Western Victoria. Has that been a factor at all in putting tilopia on the market?
No, it hasn't, because we know that these seasons happen in agriculture, and we are not doing this because we have any problems. We're more taking advantage of the growth that's occurred. And we know, because we've been in the business for 100 years, that every decade you have two good years, two shocking years, and the rest around average. So we know these things happen. We generally don't swing two of these in consecutive years, but we've got through this. And this year, even though it was probably a worse year than the previous year really set us up with the intellectual property to be able to manage it.
You are running a huge amount of sheep and some cattle on tilopia. Do you have room on your other properties for those animals, or will you need to sell some?
Livestock prices are pretty good now, so it leaves us in a pretty good position when we have that decision. It's probably our preferred option to sell this property walk in, walk out, with the staff, the competent staff, with the livestock, plant, equipment and the land. There probably is some opportunity for our South Australian properties to rebuild using some stock, and we're definitely moving our Angus stud, which is currently on Tilopia Downs, back to South Australia. But otherwise, we'll sell them in the market, or preferred a walk-in, walk-out sale.
AJ and PA McBride CEO Nathan Wessling speaking to Angus Verley about Tilopia Downs, Victoria's largest property, back on the market just 7 years after it was last sold, expecting around about $100 million. 10 to 1.
The WA Country Hour with Belinda Varischetti on ABC Radio WA.
A southwest seed potato grower is concerned the spread of a virus through potato crops in Tasmania could affect international exports. Potato mop top virus has never been detected in Australia before, and while there's no risk to human health, it rots the flesh of potatoes and can significantly impact yields. The virus was first found in Tasmania's northwest earlier this month, initially on four properties, but that number has now grown to six. Many countries list potato mop top as a restriction on their importation conditions, and Pemberton farmer Glenn Ryan says it's another blow to the potato industry.
Yeah, it's disturbing news. Not what the potato industry needs in Western Australia. We've been through a few disease incursions in the last few years. We hope it doesn't reach Western Australia, but not good news for Tasmanian growers or really any grower in Australia. It's a possibility it will come to the mainland, and then it'll be obviously extremely hard to control.
Yeah, and I understand the virus doesn't make potatoes poisonous for human consumption, but it does obviously rot the skin and the flesh and it impacts yields. How do you think what's happening in Tasmania is going to impact the market?
Well, in Tasmania, I think it potentially could have a huge impact, because a lot of the potatoes here are processed. If they've got the virus in them, my understanding would be that they would not be able to be processed, or they'd be severely downgraded. There is also a small seed component as well, and some of that does come to the mainland, and they would be very nervous about where their product can go and where it can't go. And I'm assuming there'll be a lot of testing going on, trying to clear it. So whether it comes to the mainland or not remain to be seen. And from time to time, some of that seed does come into Western Australia. I'm not sure how that will progress and what the outcomes will be there.
What do you think needs to happen to stop the spread of the virus?
Well, as much as I hate to say it, probably severely restrict, if not stop, the potatoes coming into the mainland, I think would be the first stop, to stop our patch, I suppose. And I hate to say that, because I know that affects other potato growers. And, you know, there could even be some growers in Western Australia who are relying on potatoes coming in from Tasmania as well. I think the seriousness of the situation is such that, you know, we don't want that virus in Western Australia. So everything has to be on the table, I would imagine.
Yeah, because how devastating would it be if that virus was to come over here?
Yeah, it would just be another hit. Like I said, we've had some biosecurity hits here the last 5 years, you know, several. And there are guys in Western Australia who do export potatoes to other countries, and my understanding is some of those countries won't take any potatoes if the mop top is known to be, even in Australia possibly. So I'm not 100% sure about that. So that may limit them as well and impact them. So we just don't need any further impacts, really.
Right. So overseas buyers might hear mop top has been found in Tasmania, and then that puts the entire country on the blacklist.
That would be my understanding, but I couldn't guarantee, you know, I can't say 100% for sure that would be the case, but I'm pretty confident that that would be an issue, yeah.
Glenn Ryan, he's the owner and director of Warren Valley Farm near Pemberton. He was speaking to Amelia Searson. 6 to 1. Nigel Crump is a potato pathologist and general manager of the Australian Seed Potato Industry Certification Authority. He's calling for intervention at the border to stop the virus entering mainland potato farms.
Because once we get this disease on the mainland, we'll have it forever. The virus survives in the soil within the Spongospora, the pathogen, that spreads it for up to 20 to 30 years. So we need to be very careful and make sure we don't import a problem.
So do you think there should just be more focus on quarantine and biosecurity, or do you think there just should be no potatoes coming from Tasmania into the mainland of Australia?
Look, I think it needs to be on an evidence-based approach. I mean, traditionally, this is where Australia's been very poor at, is that we do blanket bans and we just prevent trade. I think science can actually be used here, and we can actually use that knowledge to ensure that the seed we're planting is disease-free and that we don't introduce this virus into new areas.
Plant pathologist Dr. Nigel Crump, who's general manager for the peak body representing Australian seed potato growers. He was speaking to Jane McNaughton about the potato mop top virus, which has now been found on 6 properties in Tasmania. And in other news out of Tasmania, after a number of court appeals, the federal government has just approved a 100-turbine wind farm on Robbins Island in northwest Tasmania. The 720-megawatt facility will be the largest in that state in Tasmania. Federal Environment Minister Murray Watt announced the approval after it was delayed 7 times by his predecessor, Tanya Plibersek, since 2022. Murray Watt says the decision includes strict conditions from both the Tasmanian and Australian governments, just to ensure the project will be constructed and operated in a way that safeguards nationally protected species, such as the orange-bellied parrot, Tasmanian devil, Tasmanian wedge-tailed eagle, and protected migratory shorebirds. 4 minutes to 1, we'll get to the wool market details in just a moment.
Hello, I'm Andy Park. Join me for The World Today. A major raid in Porepunkah overnight with 2 arrests made, but no sign of alleged cop killer Desi Freeman, still at large in the rugged alpine Victorian high country. Russian attacks on Kyiv kill at least 20 in strikes, which highlight just how far away a ceasefire deal really is. And new data shows banks are winning battles in the war against scammers. One bank successfully recovered more than $100 million in scam and fraud-related funds.
To the wool market, which is up again this week. In the east, the market finished on 1,261 cents a kilo clean. And here in the west, up 6 cents, closing at 1,402 cents a kilo clean. Justin Haydock, the market moving in the right direction.
Yes, they are, Belinda. So we've had a really good start to the selling season after a 3-week break. As you mentioned, the EMI up 14 cents for the week. It was also up 14 cents in US terms, so closed at 818 in US terms there, with the dollar going up 0.4 of a cent. It's always good news when the market's up in US terms as well. So smaller offering than last week. We had 29,000 bales on offer, 5.4% passed in. I'll read through the market indicators. So 17 microns. In the south, they're up around 17.30 and they were up 15 cents for the week. So quite a lot of last year, they traded below 1700. So we've had a nice lift on the fines. 18 microns, they're trading at 16.35. Keeping in mind, we actually had a one-day sale here in Fremantle. So they were dearer again in the east on the Wednesday. So they're up 20 cents for the week and closed at 16.70 in the east. So hopefully we'll catch up to them next week. 19 microns, 15.50, up 10 cents. 20 microns, 1,500, up 10 cents. And 21 microns, 14.75, and they were up 8 cents for the week. So 21 microns hit 1,500 last year, earlier on in the year, and they quickly came back to around 1,420, 1,430. So it's nice to see a little bit of movement on that broader edge as well. So they're back up around 1,475.
And who was buying all the wool this week, Justin?
So major buyers for the week, PJ Morris purchased 16% of the fleece. This is nationally. Endeavour Wool Exports, 12.3%. Tech Wool Trading, 12.3%. Sequoia Materials, 11%. Cathay Tex Trading led the way with the crossbreds, 15.7%. Endeavour Wool Exports, 18.1% of the skirtings. And the oddments, United Wool Company, 24.2% in the oddments.
And how many bales will be on offer next week?
So we've got a one-day sale in Fremantle again. So we'll sell on the Tuesday. Similar numbers to what we sold this week. So 3,500 bales in Fremantle to be sold Tuesday, and 29,000 bales will be sold nationally. So two-day sale in the east. So look, as I've mentioned, market, we've had a great start to the selling season. So we'll definitely go into next week with a bit of confidence and hopefully a little bit more movement in the fines.
Justin, thank you so much for going through those details of wool sales here in WA and on the East Coast this week on the ABC News Time, 1 o'clock.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.